Talk given Sunday, 15th July 1973. We read in Genesis, the Lord God said to Adam, "In sorrow shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall the earth bring forth to thee. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return." There, perhaps, in the Old Testament, is the presentation of the state of dukkha. And consider for a moment how and why did this state of dukkha come into being. Adam took the fruit of the tree of life. And in plucking the fruit of the tree of life, it became scarred into the tree of what is commonly called good and evil. We can look at it this way. Man, having a glimpse of the transcendent, because that is the meaning of the fruit of the tree of life. It also means consciousness. It is the fruit of consciousness. The awareness of totality, the supreme state of consciousness man can realize. He plucked it, and unable to remain in that condition constantly, he became aware of the distance between himself and the ultimate real, which man can realize. And so he is in the state of dukkha, of pain. Those of us who are interested in and try to live according to the disciplines of other faiths like Buddhism or Vedanta or whatever it is, do not we also get a glimpse of this transcendence, realize the distance between transcendence and ourselves in the ordinary way, and are in a state of unease, therefore? And what do we do? Our glimpse of transcendence is always misinterpreted after the glimpse, after the beatific experience, whatever it may be. That glimpse is misinterpreted in our terms. Pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow. My fulfillment or frustration. We are unable, here as we are, to realize the meaning and significance of transcendence on its own plane. So what do we try to do? We search for transcendence, search for nirvana, the unborn the unmade, the unbecome, and so forth. Lovely words, but they are totally meaningless to us in our ignorant state. The very word unmade, which is the negative of made, is understood by us only in our limited terms of making something finite, limited, which comes into being, which proceeds, which may be used, which dies. So you see, we never escape that grip of the Lord of Death upon us. I don't mean the death of the body merely. The death of that consciousness, that perpetual consciousness of the transcendent real. So you see, to search for the transcendent, to seek it, we as we are, is a mistake. The positive movement, the positive action so-called by us in our ignorance, and I'm afraid our conceit, is an out-and-out error. We can seek positively only that which lies within the ambit of our actual experience and knowledge. You know what a Rolls Royce is. You can save money or make money, etc., and buy your Rolls Royce. You obtain what you seek. You're in love with somebody, well, you can go and grab him or her, seek him or her, and obtain it. Because you know him or her. You know a Rolls Royce. You know a house. You know a book, its name, its author. You can go and buy it. Obtain it. But do you know transcendence? Do you know God? Do I know God? And you know, the extraordinary thing is that you are transcendence. You are God embodied. These remain mere words. And the proof of my statement that they are mere words is just this, that you go out to seek that which you are. You can't go out to seek that which you are. Supposing it was my ambition to become a fool. Well, I can't become a fool, I am a fool. You see how extraordinarily deluded the mind is, how naive, childish, simpletonish, that's the word I want, simpletonish the mind is. This is the state of ignorance, the incapacity to see truly. Now consider how we practice disciplines. First, why do we practice a discipline? To obtain a particular end. But truth, reality, transcendence, nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, none of these things is a particular end. It has no finitude, no limitation. I can't seek it. I only chase a will-o'-the-wisp raised up by my own clouded imagination. Every such seeking is a grasping for the limited self. And every grasping for the limited self whether you succeed or not, is fraught with sorrow, and its end product is everlastingly sorrow. When you go out into the country and you breathe the fresh air, you're never thinking of grasping it, are you? You take it for granted, just naturally. You do the same with the light of the sun. When the sun is shining, you just go into the light. But where truth, reality, transcendence, God, the real fulfillment and fruition is concerned, we search for it, we seek it, always making some sort of picture in our minds about it. And this is the great mistake, this picture in the mind. It must of necessity, it always is in fact, a false picture. Because the mind in its state of impurity, imperfection, in the state of incapacity, is totally incapable of seeing truly. Moreover, a picture of reality is not reality. It is an image of reality, the shadow cast by the substance. It isn't the substance. You see, we constantly fall into this trap, this error. Even the great scriptures of the world, in presenting their systems of discipline, in order that the fulfillment of the purpose of existence may take place through us, have time and again used language which is misleading. The concern of the scriptures has, of course, been, the concern of the great teachers, of course, has been that there shall be liberation. They found it. They were it. I'm sorry, I said they found it. They were liberated beings. And they knew the tremendous difficulty, almost impossibility, of presenting, which could only in this case be a re-presenting of the transcendent real. But what they said, what they taught, the influence they exercised, was afterwards put into writing by disciples. And invariably, those writings are colored by the deficiencies of the disciples. Now let us consider today a statement out of this book, Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, translated, or rather edited, by Dr. Evans Wentz. And it deals with what is termed the nirvanic path. And it deals with the subject of concentrating the mind without objects, using objects to help one to concentrate. And there are just 3 points presented. The instantaneous cutting off of a thought at the very moment it arises. Leaving unshaped whatever concept or idea appears. And the third, letting the mind assume its natural condition of absolute quiescence, unmoved by the disturbing process of thought. Now, consider the words used there, concentration of mind. This is in relation to the word samadhi. Samadhi, the Sanskrit samadhi, is always mistranslated, I would say, as concentration. Samadhi, in actual fact, is the complete togetherness, the state of perfect coalescence, in which there is no separation between what we commonly call individual consciousness or mind, and the totality, whatever that totality may be. Therefore, there is no exclusiveness in it. Our word concentration means excluding everything which is not the particular subject of your attention. So you see, it denies the reality which samadhi is, the state of complete communion, of perfect togetherness within and with the total reality. This is the state of samadhi. Now there is no separation between the one in samadhi, as we say, and the totality. This is the uttermost purity, perfection, liberation, the kingdom of heaven, nirvana, anything you like. This is it. So you see, concentration is a word which belongs to the mortal context of searching, finding, etc. And yet, it is in one sense a concentrated state. It is a state of supreme intensity, of total being. You are, in that condition, total being. That is the samadhi. So in that sense, it is a concentration, an intensity of being, a perfection of being. And you will see the expression of that at our level, in our world, in the great products of genius. You look at a play written by a truly great dramatist, or look at a work of music produced by a truly great composer. The extraordinary economy of resource and the concentration in terse phrases or notes and chords and so forth. It's precise, to the point, absolute, perfect. Concentrated in that sense. Which is very different from our practice of trying to exclude everything. We are trying in samadhi, for the sake of samadhi, to be in union with the totality, not exclude anything in the totality. You see, our idea is that we want to be rid of evil, to be rid of sorrow, and so forth. But evil and sorrow are terms which express the interpretation given by me as I am in my imperfect state of that which is. That which is the totality. I don't like this part of it. I am frightened of it. I am hurt by it. To me, that is evil. So I call it evil and I want to be rid of it. But it is part and parcel of the totality, exactly as I am part and parcel of the totality. I can't be rid of it. What can change? The manner in which I am conscious of it. This is what undergoes the transformation. Time and again, haven't I said, the whole story of spiritual development, religious living, fulfillment and realization for man is the story of the complete transformation of one's mode of awareness of the totality. It is the transformation of that mode of awareness. So you see, this word concentration must be understood in its real sense, in its real meaning, samadhi. Think of it as the complete togetherness, the complete harmony, therefore. If I am aware of my total environment, which includes me, in the right way, the harmonious way, the non-separative way, then there is no rejection anywhere. There is the state of the communion of compassionate understanding, of intelligent, creative, active love. That is what happens then. This is one of the supreme meanings of the word yoga. That yuj, to join together, to rejoin in fact. To be restored to the whole. Now, take that other word which comes into the story of the growth process, the living growth process by which this comes to fruition. We talk about one-pointed attention. One-pointedness of mind. The word one-pointedness is meant to represent ekagrata, the Sanskrit ekagrata. But now look, this is a somewhat misleading translation, one-pointedness. Ekagrata means the unified state of the mind, not the fragmentary state. What is the ordinary state of our mind? It's a turmoil. It's a rag bag. It is a machine which, when you press the button, just chatters away and doesn't move and doesn't do anything constructive. It is a miserable lump. That is the ordinary state of the mind. You consider this very carefully. This doesn't apply merely to the other fellow in the street or the lower classes, spiritually speaking, or any such nonsense. It applies to me, myself. This is my state of mind. I must see the truth, really see the truth of it. If I don't acknowledge that I am suffering from a disease, I shall never try to get to a doctor and get cured, will I? I just remain the sick fool. That's all. So now, we must recognize that our mind, what we call our mind, really is in that state. Watch the flow of discursive thought. Watch the flow of feelings and emotions. Watch the manner in which the mind rises up and reacts helplessly to every single stimulus. And note how all those reactions and thoughts are inextricably bound up with greed, violence, self-indulgence, illusions, and delusions as regards both oneself and the world and what is true and worthwhile. This is the fact. Of course, we do get great thoughts, noble thoughts, fine impulses, magnificent urges, and all the rest of it. But those are the subtler enemies and tempters where we are concerned. Watch them carefully. They feed our vanity and egoism. Watch that very carefully. I am not like that fellow. I don't do such evil, horrible things. What am I doing thereby? If I am conscious of my so-called virtue in that manner, I have made the separation between him and me stronger than ever. I am not in harmony with totality. Was it not Jesus who said, "Love thine enemies"? Who is my first enemy? Myself. I don't know how to love him. So now, the mind is in this state of confusion, turmoil, and all the rest of it. And in this turmoil, you will notice that all the different sense impressions and the sense consciousnesses clamor and jostle each other for first place in relation to my attention. They clamor for my attention. Some sight, some touch, some tune or other. You know how, especially how you get a tune on the brain, and then the wretched tune simply will not leave you. It goes on repeating itself ad nauseam in your brain. All these different sense consciousnesses jostle each other, and the mind is one magnificent whirlpool of confusion. Now it's very, very important to awake to this as the fact. Because if we don't awake to the fact of it, it remains impossible to observe the second and the third items mentioned in this quotation from the Nirvanic Path. To leave unshaped whatever concept or idea appears. Now bear in mind very carefully, the context of this is the religious context, which means the context of the realization by transcendence of itself through you, the individual. the truth, the ultimate real, nirvana, use whatever word you like, the Buddha within you, whatever you like to call it, you see, comes to full awareness of itself through you, because you have ceased to be the obstruction to that realization. This is the real life process. This is the real meaning of life in all its aspects, the spiritual, psychological, and the biological. So now, any concept that I make, any idea that I set forth regarding the nature of this which is the transcendent reality, mind, or the ultimate consciousness. See, consciousness is a difficult word. I often use the word awareness, but that also has its limitations. This is where the Upanishads were wonderful. They manufactured a totally new word, Atma, to express this total transcendent reality, you see. They just used one word like that. That's why it was so useful. Every concept I make, every idea I put forth, limits the reality, is an obstruction to the reality. Therefore, any concept in connection with this ultimate reality, you must leave unshaped. Don't let it grow, because it will only be something which takes me into the ill state, not into the true, the real. If we even begin to understand this, we will appreciate the extraordinary psychological wisdom of the Buddha in presenting everything in what we call the negative formulation. Not this, not that. Transform the evil. Don't go searching for and grabbing at the good, because the good I don't know, that will emerge. The evil I know because I am it. It is very important to see this, because it is what we commonly call the negative perception, which is the real creative power in us. Not the so-called positive. In our patriarchal societies, we have emphasized the positive. We have called ourselves the males, the positives, you see. We are merely conceited. It's the female, it's the negative. It's the electron and not the proton which does all the doing and gives all the properties to the element and all its chemical activities. Not the protons. They just sit quietly inside, doing nothing, fattening upon the activity of the females. This is life. So you see, it's the negative thing that is the real doer, the bringer to life, the nurturer of life, and finally also the ender of life. It's the female who strikes dead. The negative, not the positive. Because death belongs to the realm of manifestation. And in the realm of manifestation, things come into being and of necessity pass away, die. What did the Buddha say? Whatsoever hath a beginning by nature, and nature is the female, of necessity has an ending, death. Please, don't sort of take this as a system of philosophy. This is the approach, the effort to realize truth, to let the truth emerge out of us. So now, back we come to this business of ekagrata. When we see this confused state of the mind and so forth, then we realize the necessity for letting it be quiet. And the supreme expression, supreme is a rather exalted word in this context, the most awful expression of this turmoil of the mind is the ceaseless chatter, both audible and highly vocal, and the inaudible chatter that goes on in the mind. We just don't stop talking. We cannot shut up. I'm a very good example of it here. You see, what is the meaning? The meaning in the sense of significance, the value of observing the silence then. That all this illusory, absurd, obstructive stuff which gets churned up in the mind is the very thing that prevents transcendence from flowering out through oneself. You see, it is such a tragedy. We are all like so many buds, and we blight ourselves before we blossom into the perfect flower. You see, one of the deep meanings of the word karma, as taught both in Hindu and Buddhist teachings, our self-responsibility, whatsoever I think, feel, say, do, comes back upon me. Karma, in actual scientific fact, is a total thing, not an individual thing. There is this individual aspect of it, that all my thinking, feeling, speaking, doing immediately affects the instrument, me, that thinks, feels, speaks, and does. And if this mind is in this state of disorder, disharmony, turmoil, everlastingly chattering, everlastingly flitting from here to there, senselessly, then I am blighting the bud which is myself. And it can never blossom into the flower. One has to be really sensitive to this. If you take it just as so many words which, oh, our friend at Dilkhusha spoke, they are valueless. They are ineffectual. One has to be sensitive to this, and sensitive in the right way. Intensely sensitive from within, warmly sensitive, and at the same time coolly observing, analytically, intellectually, so that you get the inner life and reality of it together with the outer structure of it as applicable to you yourselves in your life now, every single moment. This is the important part of it. Now, if you wake up that way, you will find that it will be perfectly easy. It will be the natural thing to leave unshaped any concept or idea regarding transcendence. And yet, the extraordinary paradox, when this has really matured inside you, then the few words that you speak will be words of power, of inspiration, of the least misleading presentation of the beneficence and the marvel of transcendence itself. Because did not the Holy Ones speak? They did. What did they speak? Every word they spoke, the real liberated Holy Ones, was prophecy. Prophecy means language which embodies transcendence and has the power to stimulate the listener who listens in the right way to awake to transcendence within himself. And that awakening is a sensitivity, not a formulation in thought and speech. That is why I constantly stress this inner sensitivity, this warm something. Because transcendence is life. And life is warmth, creative. Not merely making, putting things together, a put-up job. All that we do, more or less in our life, is just a jerry-built, put-up thing. Rubbish. That is why we are not at home in the world. Isn't that so? That is why we can't live as a loving family, the human family. Oh, it's so simple and so difficult. Now, let that come into being, and then what happens? This third aspect, letting the mind assume its natural condition. We haven't got to train the mind. We use that phrase. But you see, we use the phrase without knowing what it really means. We haven't got to train the mind. What is this training of the mind? We twist it, we distort it into a preconceived shape of what it ought to be. But consider, the mind is a universal reality, like space. Can I twist space about? How absurd. When I say I'm going to discipline the mind and make it thus and thus and thus, which is what it ought to be, who is the person who's laying down the this, the thus and thus and thus? It is the mind, the ignorant, clouded, stupid, incapable, devilish mind of the imperfect fellow who makes the picture. There you are, back we go, making the picture. And the picture is a misrepresentation, a false presentation of reality. Only the Lord God Himself can make the right picture and behold that right picture, the universe. Therefore it is said, behold the universe in the glory of God. Mascaro's wonderful translation of the first verse of the Isha Upanishad. He's really got the spirit of it absolutely in that translation. And why is that so? Because this picture is not a put together of paint and canvas and whatnot. It is a creation, a creative activity. Now, when we ourselves can let the mind assume its natural condition, its full creative power is unobstructed by me. And then, whatsoever is manifest through this, the living organism, which those around can see or hear or meet with and so forth, this then is the living picture. The man made in the image of God. The living man who is the living image of that creative power. You see, this is something like our possibility. I am trying to present it in words which are as little misleading as possible. And that is all that a person like me can do for whoever listens. To try and make it as little misleading of the truth as possible. And perhaps to make it as much as possible a stimulating influence for the recipient, the listener. Now, the natural condition of the mind, letting the mind assume its natural condition of perfect quiescence, perfect poise, that means, doesn't mean being static, lazy. Not at all. Perfect harmony. Perfect activity, therefore. Activity so perfect that it is invisible, it is unheard, it is untouched. It's a miracle. The reality of us is a perpetual miracle. And this mind in poise, in that kind of poise, vibrant, creative, here now, is the meaning of the word, the state of upekkha that the Buddha talks of. That state of equanimity. In that state of upekkha, the mind is like this. Supremely creative. Now, power in the supreme sense is in action. Is manifesting itself. And this power is never misapplied, misused, can never be, because in order that this may come about, the perfect harmony of love and wisdom in their transcendence are already present. You see what it means in reality to live the religious life. These are the, to me anyway, they seem to be the very deeps of religion itself. And religious living. Which in simple terms means to live like a man or a woman.